Hello and welcome back. My name is Rabbi Avi Heller, and together we're learning Masechet Megillah. This series of recordings is a joint project of the OU Department of Synagogue Services, OU Torah, and the Daf HaShavua Foundation. We are at the very bottom of Daf Yud Daled Amud Aleph. That's 14a. We're all the way at the bottom. We're just three lines up. What we've been discussing is a tradition that there are 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses whose messages are Lidoros, that we study them for all generations. So we've already discussed 4 of the prophetesses. We're going through them one by one. We've done Sarah, Miriam, Devorah, and Hannah, and we have 3 left. So what we're going to do in this recording is discuss Abigail and Huldah, and in our following recording, we'll finally get to Esther, who is the 7th one, and probably the reason why this tradition is in this tractate. So we begin with Abigail. And the story with Abigail is told in Shmuel Aleph, the first book of Samuel, chapter 25, Perek Chaf Hei. And the story is that after David becomes king, he sends a message to a wealthy landowner named Naval. And Naval is married to a woman named Abigail. Now, Naval, I don't know if it's his real name, but Naval means bad person. So I don't know if it's really his name, but it certainly describes him. And Abigail, in fact, his own wife says later that he is a Naval. He's a lousy person. In any case, David sends him a message of conciliation, asking him to host him and his men and to give them gifts as befitting the king. And Naval not only refuses David and his men, but he says, I don't know who this David guy is. I don't know who this Ben Yishai guy is. Basically, you're no king of mine. The Gemara is going to understand that as a rebellion against David's monarchy. So David says that David decides he's not going to take that, and he gets a group of armed men together, and he's basically going to go punish Naval and he's going to kill him, maybe destroy his plantation or whatever it is, but he goes after him. The Gemara understands that he is going to put him on trial for rebelling against the king. In any case, Abigail somehow finds out that David is on the way to cause trouble for her husband, and she goes in secret without telling her husband. She sets out with some gifts, and she goes to meet David before he gets there, and she finds a way to appease him and to stop him from coming after her husband. And that's the story. So 3 lines up from the bottom, towards the end of the line. Abigail, Dichtiv, as it is written, Vehayahi rochevet alachamor, Abigail was riding on a donkey, Vioredet beseter ahar, and she went down into the shadow of the mountain. Seter means the hidden part of the mountain. So the Gemara doesn't like this description. It should have said Beseter hahar. Why does it say in the shadow of the mountain? Min hahar mi ba'ele. Basically, she was on top of the mountain and she was coming down the mountain. The verse should have said from the mountain instead of saying this fancy language of in the shadow of the mountain. Amar Rabbi Bar Shmuel, so they are going to darshan it. Rabbi Bar Shmuel gives a rabbinic explanation, a Gadic explanation, and says Al iske dam haba min astarim. That what this is referring to is not the shadow of the mountain, but something that's secret. And what's secret is her dam nida, the blood of her menstruation. So related to the matter of blood that comes from a secret place, a hidden place, natla dam, she took the fabric on which her blood was, veheratalo, and she showed him. In other words, we've now created a paradigm where Abigail is asking David a nida shaila. She's asking, am I a nida or not? But the truth is, this is a setup. She's setting him up. As we'll see in a minute, because when she speaks to him in the Tanakh, she asks him, what are you doing and can you have mercy on them? It's really my fault. And he says, by the morning time, Naval is not going to have a life or any progeny. Basically, I'm going to, kill him and ruin his line. So we understand that this is happening in the nighttime. So she sets him up by showing him this Nida Shaila, which she asks him at night, Amar La. So he says to her, V'chi marin dam balayla? Nobody paskins a Nida Shaila at night. You don't have enough light. You need to have sunlight in order to be able to judge a Nida Shaila and see if it's red, like blood, or a different color, in which case it's not blood. So Amrlo, she said to him, V'chidan in dine nefasho balayla? So do you judge capital cases at night? Which also the answer is no. So she sets him up by showing him a question she knows he can't answer, and then he says to her dismissively, I can't judge a nida shaila at night. And she says, oh, but you can judge someone, you can sentence someone to death, my husband, you're sentencing to death at night. Don't you have to put him on trial during the daytime? Amar la, he says to her, that's the end of the daf. We flip the page to Yadalet Amubet. Morid b'malchut hu, he is a rebel against the king, against the kingship. V'lo tzarech l'midayne, I don't need to judge him. I can use my special powers against rebels, and I can kill him whenever I want to, day or night. Amar lo, she says to him, second line, adayin sha'ul kayam, Sha'ul is still alive. So even though you've been appointed king by Shmuel, you're not really fully king yet. V'lo yatza tivacha ba'olam, and your reputation has not yet gone out in the world. Maybe not everybody knows you're a king, and maybe Naval is not really a full rebel, and therefore you can't judge him under the laws of rebels. Now, Tosfot is really bothered by the fact that you don't have to, that there's such an extra judicial opportunity for a king to just go kill a rebel anytime he feels like it. Now, the truth is, the Rambam seems to paskin that way, that the king can personally judge him without any jury or any supporting evidence. But Tosfot instead modifies it to say that he wasn't really saying he didn't need a trial at all, only that there were certain procedural leniencies related to rebels against the king. In particular, usually when you judge a capital case, you can seal the verdict in the daytime, but then you have to wait overnight to carry out the judgment in case any new evidence would come to light that would overturn the verdict. So ordinarily, when you judge someone on one day, you have to wait until the next day to carry out the sentence. In the case of a rebel, they're arguing that he can carry out the sentence him on the verdict during the daytime and then carry out the verdict immediately that day or even in that night. Okay, so then it's not quite the same. He does need a trial. It's just certain procedural leniencies. Okay, third line of Yudalid Amud Bet, Amar La. After Avigail gives him a whole speech in which she basically asks for leniency and she praises David, so he says to her, "Uvruch." There's a missing vav here. "Uvruch tameich, ubrucha at." Blessed is your reasoning, and blessed are you. Asher chilitani, that you have prevented me hayom hazeh, from this day, even though it's in brackets, we read it. Mibo bedamim, from coming into blood. Damim tarte mashma. When he says you've prevented me from coming into blood, it says damim. And we understand that in the rabbinic usually way that it means the minimum plurality, which is two kinds of blood. Now, what are these two kinds of blood? So the Gemara is going to explain, but there's a major girsa problem here. The next 2.5 lines are taken out by some girsas. The Gra, for instance, simply removes every word from Ella, which is the next word, all the way until two lines further down, until Amra Lo. He just takes all of it out. I think it's a little harder to read the Gemara that way. But if you do take it out, what you're saying is that the two kinds of blood that he was saved from, one was killing Naval, so she saved him from executing a man improperly. I'm not saying he was innocent, but she saved him from spilling a man's blood improperly, and she saved him from pasking a nida shaila at night because she set him up with this whole thing. You know, he also didn't improperly pasken a nida shaila. So both of those relate to blood: one to killing someone, and one to the dam nida. And she saved him from both of them. If you keep these words in, then something else happens, and we're going to read it just that way. So the next line of the Gemara says, Ella, rather, so what's the second kind of blood? We know the first kind of blood is that he's not going to kill Naval. What's the second one? Milame, this comes to teach us, Shegilta et Shoka, that she showed him her legs, her thighs, the halach le'ura or le'ora, and he went by their light or by the fire that was burning in him from seeing it. Shlosha parsaot, three parsas. And Amar la hashmili, and he said to her, listen to me. In other words, he saw part of her body and became inflamed with passion and tried to seduce her. And what we'll see in a minute is that she turns him down. She rejects his advances. Now he would be saved from blood here, presumably because he would then have slept with a woman who was a nida, and that is a major crime. The Maharsha asks that it's a problem because she's also a married woman, so he would have been also guilty of adultery. So maybe the blood is his own blood that he would have been liable for the death penalty had he slept with her. But the Maharsha argues that when you have two major crimes, in this case sleeping sleeping with a married woman and also sleeping with a nida, that you would apply the Talmudic principle of kimle b'drabamine, that you only are judged, you're only sentenced for the more severe crime, in this case, which would be adultery. And he would not be prosecuted for the case of sleeping with a nida. So she didn't really save him from dam, because he never would have been prosecuted for that particular avera. In any case, the other problem that the Marsha has, and a number of commentators, are how could we understand that Avigail would have exposed her body to David? What kind of a woman is she? We understand that she's a righteous woman, and she would not have done that. So the answer that the commentaries give is that probably this was before he met her. That she was changing her clothes or bathing, and he was coming from a distance far away, and he happened to see her unawares. He had a voyeur experience where he accidentally saw her. But once he saw her, he became inflamed with passion with her, and he couldn't control himself, and he tried to sleep with her. We are going to learn a little later that Abigail was one of the most beautiful women in all of history. She's one of the four most beautiful women of all time. So she certainly had that kind of effect on men. In any case, Amra Lo, she says to him when he asks her if he can be with her, she says to him, and this is a quotation from one of the verses, Lo tihiyez zot, this, in other words, sleeping with me, will not be lecha, for you, lefuka, for a stumbling block. Or it shouldn't be something that will be held against you. Rashi understands it, lefuka, as something that makes your knees knock together. In other words, something that would cause you to be scared, or something that in which you would it creates a collapse. So she says, I'm not going to allow my body to be a stumbling block to you, so I'm telling you no. The Gemara understands, however, that zot means this is not going to be a stumbling block for you, but something else is going to be a stumbling block for you. In other words, there's going to be another woman in the future who is going to be a stumbling block for you. And here, Avigail is prophesying that in the future, he is going to have a problem with another woman. Zot, this is not going to be a stumbling block. Miklal de'ika achriti, which is to derive that there's another one. Umay nihu, who's the other one? Maase de Batsheva. Later on, David is going to sin because of his passion for Batsheva. Umaskana hachi havai. And the result, the conclusion, was like this. In other words, Avigail prophesied about Batsheva in the future, and it came true. In other words, Avigail is a prophetess. That's how we learn that she's a prophetess, because she prophesied about Batsheva. The truth is, as we'll see in a minute, that David also married Avigail. After Naval dies, he then goes back and marries Avigail, and that's the next section here. Now, the Gemara throws in another pasuk, Vahaita nefesh adonit srura betzora chayim, the soul of my master shall be bound up with the bonds of life. And this is, you know, what we say at funerals, that the soul of the deceased should be bound up in the bonds of life. It doesn't seem to have any relevance to the sugya. I can't understand how it connects, and the Marsha has the same problem. So I would just bracket it. It is a verse that's in the section that we're dealing with, but I don't know why it's relevant here, and the Gemara doesn't seem to say anything about it. But it does go on to say, ki havat miftara mineh, when Avigail left David, when she was parting from him, Amra Le, she said to him, Vehitiv Hashem ladoni, and let Hashem do well with my master, Vizacharta et amatecha, and you should remember your maidservant. In other words, remember me. She said, I want you to remember me in the future, which is probably, you know, suggesting that she was interested in him, even though she didn't allow him to sleep with her on that occasion, that she was interested in him. And so later on, he does remember her, and they eventually get married. But she sets the stage for that. She opens the door to that. So Amar Rav Nachman says, Hainu de Amri Inshi, this is what people say, there's a folk saying, Itta, women, Bahade Shuta, when they are talking, Pilcha, they are also weaving. So this is both a compliment and maybe not a compliment to women. He says that women are always thinking of the future and they're plotting ahead. So even while they're talking to you about whatever's happening right now, they're also weaving plans for the future. So this is one way. In one way, you could look at this as looking at women as manipulative. On the other hand, it's a way of saying that women are smart and thinking about the future. You take it as you want to. Ika de Amri, there's another version of this, a different folk saying. that says, Shafil va'azil bar avza ve'enohi mitaifi, that when a goose is eating its food, it pecks its head down to eat the food off the ground, but it always keeps its eyes up. In other words, it's doing what it's doing right now, but it's looking to the future. So again, here you have a situation where we're comparing women to geese. I don't know if that's a positive comparison, but at the same time, we're saying that even while they are involved in the present, they're always looking to the future. Okay, so that establishes that Abigail is a prophetess. Now, as we've seen, some of the women here are clearly prophetesses because the Torah or the Tanakh calls them, and some are not. So Abigail, it doesn't explain clearly that she's a prophetess, a Nevi'ah, but we derived it. Huldah, who is our next prophetess, she's the sixth one out of seven, it clearly says in the Tanakh that she's a prophetess, so there's nothing to talk about as far as proving that she's a Nevi'ah, but we are going to say something else about her. So Huldah, dichtiv, Huldah, as it is written, Vayelech Chilkiyahu HaKohen V'Achikam V'Achbor V'Chula. So let me set the stage, the context for this particular story. This story happens much later. It's told in Melachim Bet, Perek Chaf Bet, 2 Kings chapter 22. And the story is when Yoshiyahu became a king, Josiah, when he was a young boy, he had them clean out the Beit HaMikdash and do some repairs. He was a good king and he wanted to follow Hashem. And when they were cleaning it out, they found a Sefer Torah, according to some people, the original Sefer Torah that Moshe had written. And when they found that Torah, they used it as an opportunity to create a religious renaissance. They tried to get the people to follow Hashem again. Everybody had sort of lapsed into pagan worship and idolatry, and Yoshiyahu really tried to get them to follow the Torah again. However, at that time, according to the psukim, when Yoshiyahu read the verses of the Torah, he tore his clothes. Now, why did he tear his clothes? So possibly he tore his clothes, and maybe this is the pshat, because he was upset that as he was reading the Torah, he was seeing how many of the mitzvot the Jewish people were not following, and he was so upset that they had fallen so far from their observance of Judaism that he tore his clothes. However, the rabbinic understanding, the rabbis understand, that the Torah itself was rolled to the tochacha. So when he opened it up, he started reading about all the terrible curses that Hashem would bring on them if they didn't follow Hashem's will. And he realized that they were in a situation where they were exactly susceptible to all the curses of the tochacha, including the destruction of the kingdom. So he tore his clothes. And moreover, he wanted to know what to do. Like, could it still be fixed? So he sent a delegation to Huldah the prophetess to ask Hashem, and all of this is clearly in the psukim, to ask Hashem what the story is with this Torah and what they should do. So the Gemara is bothered by something else. The Gemara is bothered by the fact that they went to see Huldah. At the time when this was happening, which was in Yoshiyahu's reign, there was another prophet, and in fact, a very, very important prophet who was active at this time, and his name was Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu. Clearly, it would have made sense for Yoshiyahu the king to have sent his question to Yirmiyahu, and clearly it would have made sense for Huldah to say, don't ask me, go ask Yirmiyahu, even if they asked her, if he was the active one, because he was and he outranked her as far as prophets go. So this is what the Gemara asks. Uvimakom teka'e Yirmiya, in a place where Yirmiya existed, heichi mitnabaya ihi, how could Huldah have prophesied? Amri be Rav, mishmei de Rav, in the Academy of Rav, they said in the name of Rav, Huldah krovat Yirmiya haita. Huldah was cousins with Yirmiyahu. They were the same family. I guess prophecy ran in the family. V'lo hava makpid aleha. And he was not makpid with her. He allowed her to prophesy, meaning she had his permission to do it. So that's the answer. V'yoshia gufe hechi shavak. And Yoshiah himself, the king, how could he have let go of Yirmiyah and sent to her instead? He had an obligation to go to Yirmiyah. Even if Yirmiyah, who wasn't makpid with Huldah, what about Yoshiah? Amri de Rabbi Shila, in the Academy of Rabbi Shila, they said, Mipnesha Nashim Rachmaniotain. He wanted to send it to Huldah because he preferred a prophetess over a prophet because he felt that a woman would have more rachmanas, would have more mercy. And they were worried that Hashem was about to punish them very greatly, and they were looking for someone that would daven to Hashem to have rachamim on them. The truth is, the word rachamim itself comes from the word rechem, which means womb, which is the idea that women have a particular kind of mercy on their children because they came from their own bodies, they came from their womb. So rachamim and rachmanut come from the word rechem and are associated with femininity. So he was saying he felt like they were in such trouble that it would be better if they went to a female prophet. Not that she would change the prophecy, but that she would try to daven and intercede with Hashem to have mercy on them the way a mother would have mercy on her children. So Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Rabbi Yochanan has a different answer to the question of how they, why they didn't turn to Yirmiyahu. And he says, Yirmiyah lo hava hatam. Yirmiyahu wasn't there. They would have asked Yirmiyahu, but he was unavailable. Why? Shehalach lahachzir aseret hashvatim, that he went to return the 10 tribes. If you'll remember, there were two kingdoms, there were two Jewish kingdoms, the kingdom of Israel in the north and the kingdom of Judah in the south. And the kingdom of Israel was exiled before the kingdom of Judah. And so the 10 tribes were sent into exile earlier than the last two tribes. So once the 10 tribes went into exile, certain mitzvot, like Yovel, like the Jubilee year, couldn't be fulfilled if the majority of the tribes were not found in the land of Israel. So Yirmiyahu, when he saw that there was a righteous king like Yoshiyahu, went to return the 10 tribes so that they could bring back these mitzvot and do Yovel. Uminaland ihador, how do you know that Yirmiyahu brought back the 10 tribes? Dichtiv, as it's written in Yechezkel, Perek Zayin, ki hamocher el hamimkar lo yashuv, because the seller to the one who sold was not returned. In other words, Yechezkel is saying they no longer, this is now in the reign of, this is much a little later, this is at the end of the second, of the temple, of the first temple period. He was saying that they no longer were observing the Yovel period, because in Yovel, property would revert to its original owner, and Yechezkel here is saying the property didn't revert to its original owner. So the Gemara asks, counterintuitively, Efshar Yovel Batel, V'Navi Mitnabe Alav, Sheyavatel? Is it possible that the Yovel was already not being observed, and then the prophet was prophesying that it would become Batel? In other words, a prophet can only prophesy that Yovel is going to, in the future, be nullified if it exists. So based on the negative, based on the fact that Yechezkel was prophesying that in the future Yovel would cease to exist, it must have existed again. But it couldn't have. It could only have existed in Yechezkel's time if it had been reinstated. So the assumption of the Gemara is that at some point during the First Temple period, after Yovel had originally been abolished when the 10 tribes were exiled, that it was reinstated, and that Yechezkel was prophesying that in the future it would be abolished again. Okay? So Ella, it couldn't be that Yechezkel was prophesying that Yovel would be discontinued if it hadn't been already reinstated. Ela melamed sheYirmiyahu hechziran. So rather it teaches us that Yirmiyahu returned the 10 tribes and therefore they could observe the Yovel. V'Yoshiyahu ben Amon malach aleihem. And Yoshiyahu, the king, the good king who found the Sefer Torah, he was king over them. And therefore, he was king over all 12 tribes. Dichtiv, as it is written, and it says a little later, this is the next chapter in the story. After they go to Chulda, Yirmiyahu goes on a campaign of destroying all of the Avodah Zarah in Israel. And he goes around and destroys many altars, and he burns the bones of people that were involved in Avodah Zarah. And as he's doing this, there's a verse that says, Vayomer, and he said, Mahatzion halaz, what is this grave marker, asher ani ro'ah, that I see? Vayomru elav, and the people said to him, Anshei Ha'ir, the men of the city, Hakever ish ha'elohim asher ba mi Yehuda. This is the grave of the man of God who came from Judah. Vayikrat hadvarim ha'ela, asher asita ala mizbeach beveit el. And he called these matters that you did on the altar in Beit El. Now, in particular, what the Gemara is concerned about here is the fact that it's in Beit El, which is a little bit north. So Beit El is actually in the kingdom of Israel, and Yoshiyahu was the king of Judah. So the Gemara asks, V'chima tivo shel Yoshiyahu ala mizbeach beBeit El? What was Yoshiyahu doing at an altar in Beit El, which was north of his kingdom? Ela melamed sheYoshiyahu malach aleihen. What it's coming to teach you is that Yoshiyahu was a king over those tribes that had been in the north in the area of Beit El. This is kind of an elusive proof, or it's hard to understand exactly how they prove it. But in other words, the narrative here is that Yirmiyahu went and got the 10 tribes and returned them, and Yoshiyahu governed them. And therefore, once that happened, they were able to keep Yovel. Now, Rashi writes that by this time, they were only able, to keep five Shemitahs before it got discontinued again. But for a brief period of time, they were once again able to observe Shemitah and would have been able to observe Yovel. But unfortunately, the kingdom did not last very long, and they only did five Shemitahs before it was discontinued. And then, of course, the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed by the Babylonians. But the idea of the Gemara is that at the time when the 10 tribes were being returned, which was during Yoshiyahu's reign, Yirmiyahu was unavailable to prophecy, and that's why they went to Chulda. Rav Nachman Amar Mehacha. Rav Nachman brings additional idea or a different proof as to how we know that Yoshiyahu ruled over the 10 tribes, and he bases it on this verse in Hosea, Gam Yehuda, also Judah, by which he means Yoshiyahu, who was a king of Judah, Shat Katsir Lach, a harvest was put for you, and this harvest means the 10 tribes, that he gathered them in the way he gathered in a harvest, Beshuve Shevutami, in the return of the remnant of my people. The remnant of my people are the 10 tribes. Now we're going to stop there because at the beginning of the next recording, we're going to discuss at length Esther being a prophetess. Have a wonderful day.